Love lights up one area of the brain, rejection lights up another. At least that's what it looks like in images produced by the latest brain scanners. These pictures of our brains at work appear crisp and precise, but as NPR's John Hamilton reports, the truth behind them is a little fuzzier.
You've seen the images. Gray cross-sections of the human head with vivid bursts of red or yellow showing where the brain seems to be responding to something. The pictures are so clear, so compelling, that even brain scientists like Chris Baker of the National Institutes of Health find them seductive.
I look at these images of people's brains and their stuff, and I think this is really amazing. I'm actually finding a way to look at what's going on in the brain.
Then Baker starts thinking about all the ways these images can mislead a casual viewer. Most of the pretty pictures come from a technology called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. It detects tiny changes in the amount of oxygen carried by blood to brain cells. More oxygen generally means more brain activity. But it takes a whole lot of computer processing and human judgment to get from oxygen levels to a snapshot of love in the brain. Baker says the challenges begin the second you slide someone into a scanner and the machine starts looking for signals that suggest increased brain activity.
The problem with functional imaging is that the signals we're trying to get at are quite weak. And there's a lot of noise.
Noise as in irrelevant information, not actual sounds.
So one way to think about that is it's like listening to a radio station in which there's a lot of static. So sometimes, you know, the noise will sort of obscure being able to hear the people or even being able to pick up the station at all.
Some of the noise comes from the equipment itself. More static comes from the person in the scanner. Every heartbeat affects the flow of blood, which changes the signal. Every tiny head movement blurs the image. Then there's the noise from all the stuff the brain is doing that's not related to the experiment. And an fMRI study isn't as simple as listening to just one faint radio station from one place in the brain. Scientists want a three-dimensional map of activity throughout the brain. So a typical scan gathers data from 100,000 different places. And it's up to the researcher to decide which spots have something to say.
You're tuning the radio, looking across different frequencies, and for each frequency you go to, you're trying to pick up and see, was there really somebody speaking there? Did I hear a song at that particular point in time?
If so, what kind of song? Was it about love, or rejection, or nothing at all? Baker says the signals are often so weak that researchers have to stimulate a person's brain over and over again to see any pattern. Let's say you want to know which areas of the brain respond to faces, something Baker has actually investigated.
For the presentation of a single face, we may not be able to pick up anything at all. And typically, we're going to have to present lots and lots of faces to be able to sort of then look across all of those presentations of faces. On average, do we see this increase in response?
Then they'll have to repeat the experiment on 15 or 20 more people to see if the same area lights up in everyone or not. And face recognition is a pretty simple brain process compared with experiencing an emotion like love or telling a lie. Which is why scientists are wary of scans that claim to identify these things. fMRI studies frequently produce billions of data points, many of which represent static, not a true signal. Baker says that with an ocean of noisy data, it's possible to find patterns produced purely by chance.
In the worst case scenario, there are situations in which you could apparently produce a signal out of just noise.
Baker doesn't think that happens very often, but he showed how it could in a recent paper published in Nature Neuroscience. That paper is one of two published this year that suggests the results of many fMRI studies aren't as robust as they appear. Hal Pashler, a professor of psychology and cognitive science at UC San Diego, is an author of the other paper. It was published in the journal Perspectives on Psychological Science. Pashler says he and his co-authors wrote the paper because they were seeing results from fMRI studies that seemed just too good to be true. The team began to ask why and zeroed in on a statistical practice sometimes called double dipping. It's a kind of circular reasoning. Pashler says the easiest way to understand double dipping is to imagine something that has nothing to do with brain imaging.
Suppose you wanted to figure out whether anyone in a town was able to predict the temperature 3 weeks from now. So you get everybody in the town, you get them all to make a prediction, then you come along 3 weeks later and you look at how well they did. So you might find there's 50 or 100 people who did just amazingly well. Maybe they got the temperature just spot on.
You might conclude that all of these people are just brilliant at predicting the temperature. But Bachelor says that's probably not the case, because some of the people probably got it right purely by chance.
So if you test them again and have them do it again in 6 weeks, you're going to find that they'll do better than most people in the town, but they won't do as well as you think they did based on the data you collected when you first picked them out.
Pashler and Baker say that many fMRI studies do something a lot like this when they dip into the same data twice, once to pick out which parts of the brain are responding and again to measure how strong the response is. The scientists say that's probably made a lot of results appear stronger than they really are. The papers criticizing fMRI studies have been the subject of furious debate in the neuroscience world. But even the strongest defenders of fMRI acknowledge there are problems and a need to exercise great caution when transforming messy data into tidy images. Pashler says it's not just the public that gets misled by overstated results.
When you find that something that really matters, like anxiety or depression, is linked to some very specific hotspot in the brain, that's obviously a clue that investigators and funding agencies are going to use in deciding where to put their efforts in the future.
Pashler says that could mean some areas of the brain are getting attention they don't deserve, while other potentially important areas are being ignored. All because of images that aren't as clear as they seem. John Hamilton, NPR News.
One of the things the Obama administration has done is lift some restrictions on stem cell research. Scientists say they'll have a lot more freedom to do research that could one day lead to better treatments for injuries and disease. NPR's Joseph Shapiro has this story.
8 years ago, President George Bush came up with a policy that allowed federal dollars to pay for some stem cell research, but only using about 20 stem cell lines that had existed before August 2001. In the years since, scientists have learned to make much better stem cell lines, but those didn't meet approval for federal funds.
And so this created a real dilemma for somebody who was interested in starting to do stem cell research. The instinct would be to start using the newer, improved lines, but the problem was those lines would be ineligible for federal funding.
That's Dr. Arnold Krigstein. He runs a research center at the University of California, San Francisco. Krigstein says the new rules catch up with the improved technology. They'll allow federal funding for work on stem cells that come from embryos left over from in vitro fertilization at fertility clinics, but only in cases where the embryos were created specifically to make a baby and where there is clear consent from the donors that the leftover embryos can be used for stem cell research. Dr. Reynard Kington, the acting director of the National Institutes of Health, said the new guidelines would be reviewed over time to make sure that they keep up with advances in technology.
We will be, at the direction of the president's executive order, reviewing on a regular basis the evolution of the science and the discussion in the broader society of the ethical issues. And when we believe that there's a compelling need, we will update these regulations.
One thing that won't be allowed, therapeutic cloning. That's where scientists obtain stem cells by cloning a human embryo. But scientists now think they may be able to one day use skin cells, not embryonic stem cells, to create cloned human tissue. A draft of the rules was proposed in April and generated 49,000 comments from scientists, medical and religious organizations, members of Congress, and the public. The final rules take effect today. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
This time of year, you may be spending some free time doing this. Mowing the grass is tedious and repetitive, just the sort of thing you might like to hand over to a robot. Well, you can. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce has this report on the state of robotic lawn mowing.
You know robot vacuum cleaners, those little disc-shaped things that wander randomly around a room? Picture something similar, cruising across your backyard, trimming the grass.
A perfect manicured lawn, beautiful garden, green homogeneous healthy grass. Thanks to RoboMow, a fully automatic lawnmower from Friendly Robotics that does the work for you.
There are several robot mowers out there. This one is distributed by Systems Trading Corporation. Ames Tiedemann is vice president of Lawn and Garden.
The technology is here and it works.
At least if your yard isn't huge and you don't live on a steep hill. He says you have to lay down a perimeter wire, like those invisible dog fences. The robo-mower roams around within that boundary, avoiding obstacles. Tiedemann says you can program the robot to go out at a certain time, mow for a while, and then come back to be recharged.
You could program this to mow every other day, and you're done for the whole mowing season once you set it up the first time.
If these things have been around for a decade, why do you think they're not just like sort of on every lawn out there?
Well, that's a very good question. I should say that we're growing every year. But you have to realize something. There is a class of people out there that actually like to mow the lawn.
I have to confess, I do.
Bob Markovich is home and yard editor for Consumer Reports.
Sometimes I'm cursing and saying, boy, I wish I could do something else. I have to mow the lawn. And yet I have to tell you, there's a certain peaceful solace in mowing the lawn.
Markovich doesn't mow just for that peaceful feeling. Every year, his group tests dozens of mowers, including, recently, the robo-mower and another called the LawnBot.
They really are more labor-intensive than you'd think.
He says they can sometimes get stuck in places, for example, and the grass isn't left with straight lines.
They produce kind of an odd, random pattern that some may not like.
Plus, these machines typically cost more than $1,000.
I think the short and simple answer is it's still an expensive toy.
Some researchers are working on automatic mowers that are more sophisticated and more powerful. Sanjeev Singh is at Carnegie Mellon Robotics Institute in Pittsburgh. It should be noted that he personally uses an electric push mower for his own small yard at home. Still, he thinks robots could someday save money for businesses like sports fields, golf courses, and professional landscapers.
Those are serious players in the sense that they use their machines all the time.
But something like a golf course needs consistent precision mowing over large areas. To do that, the robot has to know where it is at all times. Singh has been modifying professional-grade mowers so that they drive themselves and keep track of their location using GPS or other systems.
Technically, we were surprised to see how difficult it is to be able to generate a very repeatable kind of a pattern by the mower in sort of undulating terrain.
He's tested prototypes in places like Heinz Field, where the Pittsburgh Steelers play. He says automatic precision mowing is doable.
If we were to build a mower for $100,000, it would be able to cut the grass in most golf courses or most sports fields, but it would not have very good success commercially.
He's currently focusing on ways of making the technology more affordable. Singh has done some of his research with help from a top manufacturer, the Toro Company. Dana Lawn, spelled L-O-N-N, directs its Center for Advanced Turf Technology. Lawn says robot mowing is kind of at the toddler stage now. Still, he thinks it is coming.
You know, our products are getting more and more sophisticated all the time.
He says, consider Toro's current top-of-the-line Groundsmaster 5900.
It's got four microprocessors on it. It's got a network. It wirelessly reports how many hours it's achieved. Computers are driving it.
But, at least for now, there's still a human at the wheel. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Now, emissions from cars and other sources of pollution were part of the international climate talks held at the G8 summit in Italy this week. There was a tentative agreement on limiting emissions, but the target date is decades away. The rich industrial nations would not promise to cut back their emissions in the near term, and China, India, and others in the developing world would not commit to any specific cuts. NPR's Richard Harris explains the deadlock.
All nations of the world need to act to reduce the risk of climate catastrophe. But so far, there's much more posturing than action. For example, China argues that the United States and other rich nations put most of the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, so they need to act first and most aggressively. They demand that we slash our carbon dioxide emissions by a staggering 40% in just 10 years.
Well, it's obviously totally unrealistic position, and it is not just the Chinese, it's the developing countries in general.
Eileen Clausen heads the Pew Climate Center, but in an earlier life she was a diplomat. She regards this demand as little more than an over-the-top bargaining tactic.
I think, honestly, that that doesn't work, and it does create a backlash because people think that they're just not serious.
But Clausen says actually China is serious about climate change. The government believes it's a real risk. But the country also feels it can't wean itself from cheap fossil fuels just yet. Ken Lieberthal at the Brookings Institution says China is still struggling to pull hundreds of millions of people out of poverty.
They have to build a new city for about 1.25 million people, poor people, roughly every month. And they've been doing that for several years. They're going to have to do it for another 15 to 20 years. So they figure that there is no way at this point that they can credibly commit to actually bring down their total carbon emissions.
That means any kind of global plan will have to let China, which is the world's leading emitter, emit more and more carbon for decades to come. The industrialized world, on the other hand, has acknowledged that the world needs to take dramatic action, and they've set ambitious long-range goals, but they haven't agreed to near-term action plans. That was frustrating to Philip Radford from Greenpeace USA, who was at the talks in Italy.
It's almost like diagnosing your child with cancer but not taking the kid to the doctor. It just doesn't seem like good leadership, and I think people expect better of President Obama and other world leaders.
And action from the developed world doesn't mean just cutting their own emissions. Just as important, rich countries need to spread clean energy technology and money around the world. Jennifer Morgan at a think tank in Berlin called E3G says even China needs help with good old American know-how.
The Chinese want to do things at a very large scale and very fast, and they are building an innovation economy, but their rates of innovation are much lower than ours are.
Independent of the international climate talks, the Obama administration is starting to work with China directly to help push forward clean technologies. But that makes some in Congress nervous. After all, we are helping a major economic competitor. So add this all up, and what do you get? A climate that can't tolerate much more carbon dioxide before the world gets dangerously hot, rich countries offering more rhetoric than action, and developing nations that say raising living standards is more important than cutting back on fossil fuels. Ken Lieberthal at Brookings says the net result is not good.
I think it's going to be very, very hard to avoid a catastrophe. So I think anyone who looks very seriously at this issue has to say that the future looks very, very sobering.
And the way things are going right now, it seems highly unlikely that these issues can be resolved by December, which is when the next climate treaty is supposed to be completed. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Legislation to slow climate change rolled into the Senate this week and ground to a halt. After 2 days of hearings, Democratic leaders agreed to mothball the measure until September. They blamed a busy schedule of other priorities for the delay. But in its brief moment in the spotlight, the climate change bill encountered opposition from Republicans and Democrats. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on what it will take to get that measure approved.
The energy and climate bill started out hefty, a 650-odd page prescription for a new energy economy. When it passed the House of Representatives, it had ballooned to a 1,400-page giant. That's what it seems to take to design a cap-and-trade system. It puts a cap on emissions of greenhouse gases that warm the planet and allows companies the chance to trade permits to emit those gases. In the first day of hearings before the Senate Energy Committee, Republican Kit Bond took the first of many swings at this whole notion.
I think the American people, and certainly my Missouri constituents, deserve to know how the legislation we consider will impose new energy taxes on them, kill their jobs, punish the Midwest and South, help China and India, and construct a new bureaucratic nightmare to implement a carbon cap and trade program.
The White House had sent senior officials to the committee hearing to explain how this would work, but Republican Jim Bunning of Kentucky told them it was a waste of time.
I have more than once pointed out that any action to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions will be pointless if there aren't similar limits on emissions in China, India, Russia, and other countries.
China is the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, and India isn't far behind. Bunning says if the U.S. limits emissions by itself, prices will rise here but not abroad, and that will hurt consumers and undercut American business. When the bill encountered these arguments in the House, supporters simply loaded it up with concessions to win over wavering representatives, provisions to help industry make more ethanol fuel from corn, for example. That kind of deal-making has already begun in the Senate. At this week's hearing, GOP Senator Lamar Alexander from Tennessee made it clear what he wanted to see in the bill in his questions to President Obama's Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu.
Why don't we have the same level of enthusiasm for nuclear power that we do for wind turbines? What's the reluctance here?
Well, actually, for me, you're not going to get any reluctance. I as you may know, I think the nuclear power is going to be a very important factor in getting us to a low-carbon future.
For Alexander, it's nuclear power. But every state and its senators has its own energy wish list. There's a legion of lobbyists and advocacy groups keeping track of these lists. Lisa Jacobson is one of them. She's with the Business Council for Sustainable Energy, which represents green companies and favors the bill.
You know, some states are more resource rich in coal. Others are the Saudi Arabia of wind energy, or they have strong solar resources.
Jacobson adds that the hobbled economy is also shaping the demand senators are making.
Midwestern senators in particular are very concerned. You know, they're hemorrhaging jobs.
So California Senator Barbara Boxer, the Democrat who's shepherding the bill through the Senate, is promising that it will subsidize green energy technologies and thereby create new jobs. Lobbyists and energy analysts calculate that about 24 senators are on the fence right now. Bill supporters say they'll need to capture over half of them to get the votes to pass the bill. With the postponement, they'll have the rest of the summer to try. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.